Coming up on This Week in Broadway, we talk about the passing of Marvin Hamlisch. We also talk about Dogfight and Bring It on Broadway and a possible Porgy and Bess movie directed by Spike Lee. So that and much more information, news, and reviews for Broadway. Please listen. Thanks. And welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, August 19th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. And also, he also writes for outlets such as NPR.org and Arts America. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You can read his writing at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critchaland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
You also have an impending deadline coming up in a couple of weeks, don't you?
Yeah, I'm going to make it, though. My book is due September 1st. Actually, I'm having trouble cutting back now. I have too many words. As the King says in Once Upon a Mattress, and I have a lot to say. So we'll see how much I have to say today. But anyway.
Great. And that's your, it's the title. Remind us of the title again. That's
And the Winner Wasn't. It's a book about the musicals that were nominated for the Tony Awards, 156 of them, but lost. So some only get a passing mention, like "Oh, Captain," which I don't have much to say about. Some we go into great detail. Would it surprise you that that's Follies? But anyway, that's the book. But I'll make it.
I think that's a great title.
Thanks.
Speaking about Follies, we last week's show with Bruce Kimmel, we got a lot of great feedback from listeners, and it did take up our whole hour. Last week, so we didn't cover reviews and news the way we normally do. And one of the big things that happened in the last week that we haven't talked about was the passing of Marvin Hamlisch. So, Peter, what can you say about Marvin? That
well, you may recall that 2 days before he died, we were speaking about him at least obliquely because of the Nutty Professor musical that's down south, and. And I was saying at that time that there are a precious few songs, if any, that Marvin Hamlisch ever wrote that I don't like. So it's you can look it up and listen. That's what I said. So I'm not being sentimental here because he had died. I really felt he was very much unappreciated on Broadway. And I think that's what happens after you have a mammoth hit like Chorus Line. People want you to follow that act, and they want things to be as extraordinary as they were. So it's very hard when you start off with a smash hit. And I enjoyed very much his music for their Playing Our Song, which was very different, but I found it very tuneful. In the ballads, I think, are very lovely, too, in that show. I was tremendously enthusiastic about Smile, much more than Marvin Hamlisch was himself. Huh. We argued about it quite a bit because I thought it was a terrific show. A lot of people say, no, it's not. It doesn't have the bite of the movie. As a result of this, I watched the movie a couple of weeks ago, and frankly, I like the musical better. I think there are some plot twists that are substantially better, and his score is so good, and I wish that there were more than just that synthesizer recording of it that was never released. I asked him, why don't you have it released? He just did not like the show, and when you think of it, one can sort of understand why, because this wasn't the first version of Smile he wrote. There's also another version of Smile he wrote with Carolyn Lee, and when that didn't work out, he came to Howard Ashman, who then said, Marvin, I like your title song, but I don't think I can use anything else. And he wrote yet another score. Only the title song, which is delicious, by the way, was the only one retained. So I guess that's why he came down so hard on it. The Goodbye Girl, I think, has a lot of lovely numbers, and I'm still convinced that that show was sunk by Santa LaCosta's set design, which looked like it cost $1.50. And maybe, of course, they didn't have the money to do much more than that, though you would think a show with Bernadette Peters and Marvin Short would have no shortage of investors. and Sweet Smell of Success. I thought was a magnificent score. It really sounded like that pre-rock New York 50s. It really had that film noir sound. I thought it was just wonderful, and I have no idea why it got the bad reviews it did, though. We, as I often said, we're living in an age where if you aim high and you just miss, you get lousy reviews, while if you aim low and hit those low targets, you know, you get raves. So I really felt bad. There were so many other projects he had worked on for a while. Cinema Paradiso, I know he was doing for a while, and that didn't come off. Also, Bullets Over Broadway, he was connected with for a while, and now we're getting that, but with no original score at all, which depresses me. So I don't think we appreciated Marvin Hamlisch enough, because he really was a Broadway baby, dating back to his time when he was rehearsal pianist on Funny Girl and working with Henry Sweet Henry. And I remember that's where he told me that, of course, that's where he and Michael Bennett met. And as he said to me, I am not losing touch with you, Michael. I am putting you in my address book, but I'm not putting you under either M or B. I'm putting you under G for genius. I remember he was telling me that. And he said he always kept his phone number and address information on that in the G section of his address book. So I am very, very sorry that this happened, of course. And we'll see what the Nutty Professor is like. I hope this isn't a barrier. I can't imagine it really will be, because Rupert Holmes, the lyricist, is no stranger to writing songs, melodies, and we'll hear some of them, of course, not so far in the future when his Mystery of Edwin Drood, or Drood, if you will, comes to town. So, but still, I would have preferred a total Marvin Hamlisch score.
Michael, what'd you think?
Well, Peter mentioned the word genius. I was thinking of that word in relation to Mr. Hamlisch. I certainly think it applies. I met him briefly a couple of times, and actually it's funny. He was very nice and very, very friendly. But it did seem like he was going from one thing to the next in his mind, even like almost as I was speaking with him. And I mentioned that to a mutual friend, and he said, well, that's the genius thing going on. I don't know if you've had this experience. There are some people who, the true geniuses, it almost seemed like, I don't want to say ADD because that sounds negative, but they have so much in their brains, so creative that they, I mean, obviously they can focus when they need to. So it's not a lack of focus. But I mean, in social interactions and things like that, they're just this really amazing stuff going on. And I think that I really think that seemed to be him, just from what I could tell. He was so multi-talented. He was constantly working in different venues. I mean, as a conductor, as a film score writer, as a Broadway musical writer. I don't know about you, but I was shocked when I was on vacation when somebody texted me that he had died, and I literally gasped when I read.
Sure, I didn't know that he was even ill.
But how awful, and people are rightly, I think, comparing him to Gershwin. I mean, how many people can be compared to Gershwin without it being an embarrassment? But he, even though this was pointed out as his funeral, although we got 30 more years of life from Marvin Hamlisch than George Gershwin, but it's still a tragedy, because it seems he had so much more to give. I am happy, at least, that it would seem that Nutty Professor, based on its out-of-town premiere, could be another big hit for him. And I also do wonder, I'm a little confused, because it seems like the reports we're reading are saying, what is the future of the project now? But I wonder if they really feel like there was that much left to be done, and particularly in terms of the score itself. I mean, do they feel like there were several songs that didn't work and need to be replaced? It sounds like a very full score, so I don't think they feel that they need to just add things necessarily. So I don't know if it will be necessary for Rupert Holmes to actually, you know, I mean, I don't know how much it will necessary for him to be actually will he need to write entirely new songs, music, and lyrics, or maybe just tweak what's there.
I imagine we're talking about a song or two or three, because but I mean, aside from "Kiss Me, Kate," I mean, every show that's gone out of town has come in with new songs and songs dropped, and I can't imagine it'll be any different with this one. That's just the nature of the beast. But nevertheless, I suspect we'll hear much more Marvin Hamlisch music than we will hear Rupert Holmes music, but still, I can't imagine that there won't be work done on the show, and that we won't hear other songs as well. But I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the Hollywood thing too, because his work there was really quite wonderful. The Way We Were really is a song that genuinely deserves to be called a standard. One still hears it today, here and there. And I mean, after all, we're talking about close to 40 years now. I'll tell you, you know, the movie The Fan takes a lot of heat. a lot of people hate it like poison. But I think his ballad in that, called Hearts Not Diamonds, with a lyric by Tim Rice, I think is a really pretty song. I think it is quite fine. And the song for the James Bond movie, Nobody Does It Better, is a very nice song too. So I just wish that Broadway had appreciated him more, because I think he would have done more. But I do think when you have a hit like that, boy, you have a lot to live up to. And we just don't forget it. So,
did either one of you go to the memorial?
I wasn't able to. Really, this book is stole. So much as I wanted to, I really could not. So,
I didn't make it either. I had mixed feelings. On the one hand, I really wanted to go in one sense, but I heard it was incredibly sad, as you might imagine. It's the whole thing is that kind of thing cathartic, especially if you don't know the person personally. Is it cathartic, or, you know, is it ultimately a good thing for you to be there? I guess there were some beautiful moments, apparently, that, and you can see some of them or hear some of them on YouTube. This huge chorus of people singing the way, I think they did they do both The Way We Were and What I Did for Love?
What I Did for Love was definitely a part of it.
Yeah.
Ed Kleban didn't want it at his memorial, but certainly Marvin Hamlisch would have at his.
Oh.
It's, I was pleasantly surprised to see that President Clinton was there. I didn't
Wasn't
know
that something, huh?
That they had a relationship. And
wasn't that something?
And it just shows you the breadth of the impact that he's had, all over the world.
Yeah, and Margaret was there. I don't think there was a lot of coverage of that. I suppose he worked with her years ago, you know. Amazing.
So, it happened a couple of weeks ago, but we wanted to touch base with everybody and talk a little bit about it, because we had mentioned it, and it has a dramatic impact upon Broadway and the theater world worldwide.
Oh, and so, I do hear that there will, from a very reliable source, that there will be a Broadway memorial as well in a Broadway theater sometime in the fall. So keep your ears open for that.
All right. So something else that we hadn't talked about in the last few weeks is Dogfight, which is it's over at Second Stage, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Dogfight?
Yes, I'd love to. I mean, I think maybe Peter talked about it a bit, because he had seen it before me, and I got to it late, and then I went away on vacation. But I had to bring it up because I loved it overall. I loved the score, and this was my first actual exposure to Pasek and Paul. So I'm so thrilled that I liked it as much as I did. I thought I have nothing negative to say about the score whatsoever. I'm fascinated by the construction of the show. Based, I assume, very, very firmly on the source material, which was a film. And as I'm sure most of our listeners know by now, even if they haven't seen the show, it's set in the early 60s, and mm-hmm. it's about a bunch of Marines in San Francisco just before they ship out, and they are having a dance at which the goal is for each of them to bring the ugliest date that they can find, and whoever brings the one who is judged to be the ugliest by the others wins some money. So obviously it's a very, very mean-spirited, dark tale. Now, and because of that, I'm surprised that it worked as well as it did, but I think that this musical would work 10 times better if they made one change. And I wanted to ask Peter about that, because as it is now, we are told right at the beginning what the plan is, what the setup is for this dance, find the ugliest date and bring them. Then we see several of them, and specifically the main character, Eddie Birdlace, played by Derek Klena, trying to find the ugliest girl they can find. And Eddie finds this girl working in a restaurant, and her name is Rose, and she's played by Lindsay Mendez. And we see him, basically courting her, really kind of coming on strong and being utterly charming and to get her to come to the dance. And she's, of course, a very sweet, wonderfully sweet, good-hearted girl who is not necessarily very attractive, and especially as she, as Lindsay Mendez is made up in the show. But we know what his objective is, and it's incredibly, it's very off-putting, I found, for us to know what he's doing and that she has no idea of it. And she's so sweet and loving, and then she goes to the dance with him, and then they have this thing where while the GIs are, while the Marines are dancing with their respective ugly dates, somebody holds up cards rating them as to their ugliness, and that's how they're finally judged. And then at the end of the dance, or at some point during the dance, she finds out what the deal was, and of course she's tremendously, tremendously hurt. But the thing is, I think it would have been much better if we didn't find out until she did, because then we wouldn't. And then subsequently, if we had gotten some kind of explanation about why Eddie participated in this, because I think it's really important for us to be sympathetic to him. And it's very hard to do that when we see him cold-bloodedly setting her up for this humiliation. And I just somehow think that if we didn't know while we were watching him ask her on the date and forming this relationship with her, and if we only found out afterwards and then it was explained, that he did it through peer pressure, blah, 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 to me that would have made it much better, because the whole first part of it up until she found out was, was just really very, very off-putting to me. And I wonder if they considered doing it the other way. And I wonder what Peter's take on that is.
You know, it's funny you say this, because I may have mentioned that I had heard about this type of party about 3 decades ago when an actor was sitting in my apartment and told me about doing this, participating in this event, which he less euphemistically called a pig party.
Was this related to the military or not?
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He went to Vietnam as well.
Oh.
The issue came back so clearly to me that I actually saw him sitting in my apartment, and it was so clear to me that I actually saw the stools that I used to have in this apartment. I forgot that I even had those stools until the memory of that picture in my head came back to me. So it was that potent to me. And I thought at that time, wow, this would make a tremendous story, be it a play or a movie. But it's funny, Michael, I saw it the way you did. I really thought that if it were to be done, that indeed we would find out when the girls found out what exactly was going on.
Well, so, I'm really glad to hear you. I mean, I really wish
I really mean that, too.
That I could see it. I wish I could see it if they had written it that way and see how much difference it would make, because it's so cruel. It's so awful to sit there watching him, you know, do this to this girl and her being completely unaware of it. Now, of course, that nothing, in a sense, nothing would change even if we found out later, but we wouldn't have to watch her being so sweet in the restaurant to him and being so trusting and loving. And then, you know, we wouldn't know. And I also think that just dramatically, you know, it would be more effective to have it come as a complete shock to us, as it does to her. So I do wonder if they thought of that. I imagine it's not that way in the movie. I imagine.
I guess not too.
But I may ask them if I ever meet one of them. I may ask them if they consider doing it that way.
Mm. Yeah, really. I mean, you would get the greatest gasp in the theater at that point, since we learned that Diana was seeing Gabe. I make no more statement than that. Some people will know what I mean immediately, and if not, people who wind up seeing this musical will not, who don't know this musical yet, won't be, won't have it spoiled for them. So anyway, you would hear that type of gasp, and I hope that indeed they follow your advice. I'm sorry I didn't think of it, since I really did envision it that way when the situation was first brought up to me many moons ago. So you're right.
I think so, but you know, but I guess we wouldn't know until we actually saw it. That
indeed, but it certainly sounds like that would be a good thing to do.
Yeah,
Michael, you should look into a line of becoming a dramaturg. That sounds like a great idea. It seems so. You know.
Oh yeah, it does seem obvious.
The best ideas are always the most obvious ones that people have never thought of, and. It's, you know, if we get back to that, your point before about the genius, that's a genius idea.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, I, you know, but I wonder, it seems so obvious that maybe they did think of it, and then maybe they tried it and felt it didn't work, or maybe they didn't want to deviate the film that much. I imagine I'll be meeting Pasek and or Paul at some point, because they have so much going on. I will ask them that, because I'd really love to know.
Did they write the book or just the music?
Well, they wrote just the score, but who wrote? Peter Duchan, Duchan?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know him. I don't know him at all. So I wonder.
All right. So moving forward, we haven't talked about Bring It On as well. And so, Peter, why don't you start us with Bring It On?
You know, most critics I've read have said, oh, it's fluff. It's fun. I mean, the reviews have been positive. Don't misunderstand me. But fluff and fun. You know, I think there's more to it than that. And I really admired Bring It On. I thought the book was really, really solid. Because when it starts, there's Campbell, this cheerleader who has now become head of the squad, and she's going to mentor a young woman who's a sophomore, and she's also been in competition with another girl for the captainship. So and now they're interested in winning this big championship trophy and all that kind of stuff. And it's very hard for an adult to think this is the be-all and end-all, you know, winning a championship trophy in a high school, because most championship trophies in high school are sitting in basements or in attics now collecting dust. So it doesn't seem to be a very important goal, and it's going to be very hard to get it. But you know something? Jeff Witte knows this. He knows this very well. What is so fascinating about Bring It On is that by the end of the show, the trophy is not what matters at all. Now, the sophomore that we're talking about is named Eva. And I don't think, as accidental as it might seem, because one is reminded about all about Eve when watching Bring It On in the best sense of the word. Because what happens is that there is a possibility that Eva has been doing some manipulating so that she can somehow become head of the cheerleading team at Truman High School, by the way. And the thing is, you know, I mean, this show keeps you guessing substantially longer even than All About Eve keeps you guessing. It is deep into the second act before you are really 100% sure if Eva is guilty or innocent. Much credit is due to the actress playing Eva, because she really seems like a nice kid. And I think really that that is an important component of the show. So my hat's off to Elle McLemore, who plays the role. My hat's off to Taylor Lautenman, too, who plays Campbell. And for that matter, Kate Rockwell, who plays Skylar, the other girl who we think is going to turn out to be the real difficult girl. A girl who has very shallow values. Skylar does and is very much at home with them. All right. Now, this really becomes more interesting because if you're thinking about All About Eve, this is a story where Margot does something bad. And we don't see that coming at all. So that's one big nice surprise that's thrown at us in the second act. Frankly, there's another character in the show called Danielle. Again, very well played by an actress named Adrienne Warren. So many of these people are making debuts. I dare say we have some contenders for the Theater World Award next year already, but for the Theater World Awards already. But Danielle is an interesting character who I'd like to know more about. What happens is Campbell's is the victim of redistricting. Politicians redistrict, and she now has to go to Jackson High School, which is in the inner city. I will say that one regrettable thing about Bring It On is that when we see Truman High School, we don't see any black kids. When we go to Jackson High School, we see mostly black kids. And the implication is that this is a dangerous and difficult school. And I hate the idea that because it's mostly black kids, therefore QED, it's dangerous. I wish there were some black kids in the early part of the show when we're at Truman High School. Needless to say, Jackson, the kids there are not interested in cheerleading. Campbell has to get things going over there because she wants a team and she wants to beat Truman High School. Does she beat Truman High School? Again, what's so interesting is the journey these girls make and what they learn along the way. That's much more important than that trophy. It's also fascinating to watch the cheerleading routines in the competition, because when I was watching these routines between Truman High School and Jackson High School, I said, one is better than the other. And it was interesting. I'm trying like hell not to give the plot away, but and I don't think I'm succeeding very well. But nevertheless, it is fascinating to me that the team that I thought should win won. And because I thought they were substantially better. And I didn't necessarily see that coming. By the way, a lyric that I think is really a great lyric is when Eva sings to the Truman kids, "I'm going to have a trophy, and all you're going to have is friends." Whoa. Does that tell you something about values? So as a result, I have to say it's not my type of music. I will never listen to the cast album. And that doesn't mean that Tom Kitt and Amanda Green and Lin-Manuel Miranda did not do a very good job of what they're doing. It's just not my type of music, but it's the music that it has to be because it's the music of high school kids. So I am delighted with Bring It On's success. I am thrilled to hear that it's going to extend. I think it's going to bring a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. But to me, it wasn't just fluff. It wasn't just fun. It really packed a wallop in terms of telling what's important in life. So I respected Bring It On, which is something I didn't expect to have happen. And by the way, as the co-author of a book on cheerleading, Yes, it's true. That book sold 400,000 copies. Frankly, I was the as-told-to guy. I was brought in to just make the sentences make sense because the cheerleading expert was not a writer. I can certainly say that these girls did very good Herkimers. That will only mean something to people who know anything about cheerleading, but nevertheless. So good luck to Bring It On. I think it's going to be around for a while.
Michael, what do you think?
I completely agree with Peter. I think sometimes people, they look at a show and they think just because it's about high school cheerleaders, it's got to be mindless and fluffy and silly. You know, I don't think that's a very helpful approach to something. You have to take things in context. And I agree that there's more to it than just silly fluff, although it's certainly one of the most entertaining shows I've seen in a long time. I wish people wouldn't do that because it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction that's not very helpful, especially from a professional critic, for those who did that. I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was tremendous fun, tremendously entertaining. I will be listening to the cast album because although it's not my number one favorite type of music, I thought it served the story so well. And that's usually that's usually my prime reason for listening to a cast album as opposed to a collection of songs. Jeff Witte did a terrific, terrific job. By the way, I am completely unfamiliar with the source material for this show as well, which again was a movie. Did you see it, Peter?
Well, it's very interesting you say that because I have a tiny story attached to that too.
Okay.
A couple of weeks ago, I went to the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival to see King John, and I had time to kill. So I was passing, I didn't know where I was, so I was just driving around, and I passed a thrift shop. And I went in because you never know what you're going to find. And there was a shrink-wrapped, mint copy of the movie of Bring It On for 50 cents. And I said, I'm seeing it on Wednesday. I guess I should buy it and watch the movie. And I thought, no, I just can't bear to watch this movie. Oh, I don't want this living in my house. No, I'm not going to buy it. Now I'm thinking of driving back and getting it. I have not seen the movie. Go on.
So we can only judge the show on its, in its own right. And I think it's spectacularly successful. It's really hard for me to find anything negative to say. I think maybe there were a few too many moments of where there were like soft introspective ballads. And of course don't get me wrong. You need that even in a fluffy, lighthearted show. But I thought maybe there were just a few too many of those and some of those could be cut out. I really, really enjoyed the cheerleading, the tumbling, the flips. There's some amazing examples of that in this show, really. And especially for someone like me who's not normally exposed to that stuff. It was quite thrilling, really. I love the way that the score hangs together, even though I guess what happened is that I'm assuming what happened is that Tom Kitt and Amanda Green wrote the bulk of it, and then Lin-Manuel Miranda came in and maybe worked specifically on, there are several songs that are in a sort of a rap or hip hoppy style, which he did so incredibly well in the Heights. So I guess that's what happened. But regardless of how exactly it played out, the music is credited to Tom Kitt and Lin-Manuel Miranda, and the lyrics are credited to Amanda Green and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I think the score is fantastic. I think Andy Blankenbuehler did a terrific, amazing job in I didn't double check. Isn't this his first major credit as a director and choreographer?
I would think so.
I think so. And so I'm really looking forward to more work from him. I thought it was wonderful that this is a show where one of the relatively few examples where the cast really were credible as high school students. I mean, most or all of them are at least a few years older than that, but they all really look like they could be in high school, or you know, it, you know, pretty much like within a year or two. And they certainly have the spirit and the energy. So I thought that helped greatly in terms of the story. This is very much a story that's very much about the women, I would say, more than the men. But having said that, even the way the men are worked into it, I thought was done very well. There's a character who's he's apparently he's either a transvestite or a transsexual, but it's just taken completely for granted by the kids in that school. And I think, and regardless of how believable that is, and I won't get into that because I really don't know. I mean, I just thought it was wonderful the way we didn't have to spend all this time discussing his situation and explaining it. I thought that was terrific. And
what's also interesting about that too is how the audience adores him.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And you know, I have seen this before in recent shows that when a drag queen comes on, and by the way, I am told he's supposed to be a transsexual. But anyway, I imagine at first glance, people assume he's a drag queen. How drag queens now on stage really get a great deal of applause from moment one. And they are beloved from moment one because people really appreciate the courage it takes to do this in public. It's becoming more and more common, Lord knows. But nevertheless, that the cheers that happened for this guy and the immediate love for this guy was so palpable that, again, I think that people have come to a situation where they really admire people who go out in public, who be themselves, who have the courage to be themselves. That's what I think it's all about. Right. And I think it's very wonderful to see that type of enthusiasm for tolerance. So I took to that immediately. I've interrupted you once, so I may as well keep going. One of the interesting things is the song list does not tell us who sings what. And there's a good reason for that too. I'll only say a very good reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you just get to look at the numbers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I don't think I noticed that until you mentioned it. That's very telling. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But also, on that note, the one thing I think maybe I disagree with you, Peter, is I didn't have the same reaction to the race aspect, because to me it was not so much that the second school had all these black people. To me it was that it had a very mixed student body, including this drag queen or transsexual who is just completely accepted. And that's what these, the kids in the first much more Lily White school were reacting against. I mean, there's a lot of not so subtle racism, I think, on the part of those kids in that school. I see what you're saying, but I had a slightly different take on it. Mm-hmm. To finish, Neil Haskell, who I saw in a replacement cast in Altar Boys, does some amazing dancing and tumbling and flying through the air in this. It's a small role, but he just, I couldn't believe what he was doing on stage. It was great. And also, I thought it was so wonderful how there's a character named Randall, played by Jason Gauthier, who's another real newcomer. Sort of develops a relationship with Campbell, the lead girl, and it seems so natural to me that the way their relationship develops and so believable and so sweet, and just the way he has a wonderful line at the end that I won't say it because I thought it was a highlight. And when he said it, the entire audience kind of just sighed because it was so believable and so sweet. So the writing of that relationship I thought was terrifically well done. I love the show. I think it's one of the best new shows I've ever seen. In a long time. I think it succeeds at what it wants to do, and I think it does have more depth than most people would give it credit for. I agree with Peter. I'm so happy that it came to Broadway. I think it's interesting that so many people had it written off, before seeing it, and now it has extended greatly, hasn't it? It was supposed to.
Sure. Three months.
Yeah. Right. So I'm thrilled, and how, you know, and the St. James has another hit after several not so great experiences, you know. So that's great. I'm so happy.
It's tangentially to this is Patty Murren, who did Lysistrata Jones.
Yes.
Wrote some very kind things about Bring It on Facebook. And in fact, Patty's also just opened up in Wicked on the Road. But it was interesting to see the all the cheerleaders pulling together here. And I was going to ask you specifically both about having seen the movie, but Michael, you preempted me on that. But it reminded me of the story that Peter had about a year ago when you had remind me if I got this incorrect, that you had seen a DVD of Porgy and Bess for sale for very inexpensive, and you were going to get it from Michael. But
I did. I came through.
He bought it for me. I have it right here. It's fine.
Oh, I thought that you went back and it wasn't there. I was wondering if that's the same thing that's going to happen.
No, I think Peter said that he subsequently, that the store closed.
Oh, the store
and reopened
closed.
Again, by the way. So it's still available. For anybody who's in the New York area, if you take New Jersey Transit, an 18-minute trip to Penn Station, Newark, there is a shop in the arcade in the building not far from it's easily connected. You go up an escalator. I don't know the name of the store. But yes, Porgy and Bess is still there.
I think
the 1959 James, movie for $7.99.
Yes, with Sidney Poitier and Dorothy Dandridge. I think James is using this as a segue. But before he does, I wanted to mention I read recently about there's going to be a 70 millimeter film festival in Silver Spring, Maryland. I think it might be starting now or soon, and I did a triple take a couple of months ago when I first read about it because it listed Porgy and Bess. I mean, now as far as I know, Porgy and Bess is barely available in even a decent 35 millimeter print, let alone 70. So I called the place, but unfortunately I got someone who really didn't seem to have any idea what she was talking about or any interest in my question. And all she finally said is she supposedly went and asked someone and said, this is a print from a private collector. And I said, all right. Well, you know, so I was really planning to go and chance it, even though it sounded. But now I hear that screening has been canceled. So, and that is because, you know, in a nutshell, the movie of Porgy and Bess is almost an abandoned film because apparently the Gershwin estate hates it or hated it when it came out, and the rights eventually reverted to them for some reason because of the way the contracts were signed, and they I guess now have complete control over it, and so we don't know what condition the elements are in. It was Samuel Goldwyn, and that studio doesn't really exist anymore. The film is probably in great need of restoration, but and it is of historic importance, you know, aside from all of its flaws because of the cast: Dorothy Dandridge, Sidney Poitier, Brock Peters, Sammy Davis Jr., Robert McFerrin dubbing the singing voice of Porgy. So I don't know. I keep hearing conflicting things. Now I'm hearing that maybe the Gershwin estate now has a better attitude towards it because now, especially now that they've tried unsuccessfully, in my opinion, this new stage version of it. But now I heard just now from James for the first time that we may be getting a new movie version.
Yeah, I actually hadn't even thought about making that a transition, but you've connected it. So, there was news this week that Spike Lee was thinking about making a film version of Porgy and Bess.
Well, it'll probably have many more close-ups than the 59 movie. That's what's so astonishing about the 59 movie, that it almost seems like it was filmed from the back row of a theater. because I think there are two or three close-ups in the entire film. And what's so strange is that if you see the soundtrack album, you will notice that it's a very tight shot on the cover of the soundtrack album of Porgy and Bess clutching each other. That's not remotely in the film. I mean, not in the way that it looks on the soundtrack album. So obviously they caress, but I mean, there are so many long shots. It's flabbergasting.
And not only that, Peter, but as I think we mentioned, not only are there almost no close-ups, but there's very little camera movement.
Compared
to it's very strange because Otto Preminger, who directed it 5 years previously, had directed Carmen Jones with some of the same people in the cast. And that film, even though it's earlier and was very, very early CinemaScope, is fine in terms of close-ups and camera movement. So I don't know what... The Porgy and Bess film was just seems cursed from the beginning. There was a fire on the set, and they basically had to rebuild the entire sets right before filming began. Some people at the time suggested it was due to sabotage because the property was, had already started to be considered racist and derogatory by a lot of people. Sidney Poitier was on record as saying that he did not want to do the film and was basically forced into it. Because of, just other things he wanted to do. It was just a very, very unhealthy, I think, environment for a film to be produced. So, I would love it if there could be another really well done film of it. I would hate to think that it would be based on the version that is now on Broadway in terms of the rearrangements of the score and the changes of the keys and the changes in the lyrics and the rewrites and the additional ridiculous dialogue by Susan Laurie Parks. I hope they don't do any of that, but there's no point in speculating, really, I guess.
Michael, speaking of hate, what time is your parade today for the closing of End of the Rainbow? I understand you have marshaled all your troops and you'll be leading the parade and throwing the baton in the air and thrilled that Tracy Bennett will no longer be on Broadway. Is this true, Michael? This is a rumor I've heard.
No, I think it's better to kind of just let it die quietly to the death that it deserves. I really cannot stand the show and I really didn't like the performance either.
I thought she was awfully good.
Yeah, I know you did.
Peter, you did? I'm shocked about this.
It is interesting. It's really interesting how, as I've said before, you're not the only person I respect that I cannot understand. I cannot conceive of how you like that show or that.
Yes, and similarly speaking, Michael, you're not the only person I respect who hates it like poison as well.
On the one hand, it gets me upset, I guess that's the word. But on the other hand, it is really interesting because you have to look. I mean, I can't dismiss your opinion.
How can I dismiss yours?
To look and say what, and I try to figure it out in terms of like facts, like factual reasons, like logical reasons why we feel but you can't do that because it's
people are offering me bootleg videos all the time. Somebody recently offered me The Desert City. Somebody recently offered me Venus and Fur. I'm not interested in these in theater tapings where you see people's heads moving around and suddenly you see the ceiling because an usher is coming down the aisle. I hate these things, but I'd take one of End of the Rainbow. I really would. I'll take whatever I can get from that.
Is it actually set definitely to tour?
I don't know. I suspect that may very well be a euphemism, as they all say they're going to tour, and then tours don't happen. It's a way of saving face. I hope it does.
And another thing that may or may not be a euphemism or just hype is, have you heard that there was some talk of some kind of a film?
No, I haven't heard that. I'll take that too. That'd be fine. Anyway, but Anyway, let us know what time the parade starts. So that
I don't know. I'm sorry. I mean, I really appreciate her performance in terms of her commitment and her energy.
Sure.
And I'd love to see her in other things. I just don't, I think she
sure.
She only sounded vaguely like Judy Garland when singing, and nothing at all like her when speaking. And then, but my main thing was that I just felt that the piece was so tremendously disrespectful. Everyone knows how I feel. I quoted the Michael Feingold piece, which I think he, you know, was more eloquent than I about. It's the whole train wreck aspect. But it's interesting too, Peter. You said that I believe you said that you responded to the show in terms of that you're fascinated by what it's like to work for an awful boss.
Right.
And I can understand that. I mean, that's why I wanted to see that play that I missed that apparently was so great. What was the off-Broadway play?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Assistance.
Assistance, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess to me in this case, it would be different because apparently the poor woman was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and not even necessarily her own fault. So to me, that's less interesting than someone who's just like an incompetent boss
or unreasonable. You know,
Yeah. But I understand that aspect of it also, and I for what it's worth, again, I thought that the I thought the best written character in it was the part played by Michael Cumsty. He seemed very well written to me and very well acted too, I would say, in the way that he was so sympathetic to her, but also at a complete loss. You know, I mean, at one point he offers to marry her.
Because he loves her so much.
And he was probably not the only person who would want to marry her just to protect her So I thought that to me was the part of the play that I really responded to.
Michael,
if I might say something positive about it.
Michael, we got off of Porgy and Bess just a little bit too soon. You wanted to talk about something in the opera news.
Oh yes, well this plays into what we were just saying about people we respect. I opened my opera news to find an article by Brian Kello, who's the I forget his exact title, features editor, executive editor, managing editor, saying that he only recently caught up with Porgy and Bess. He said he almost missed it because he had been hearing so many negative things about it, including an article that had appeared in Opera News a few months ago that was extremely negative about the changes that had been made, the adaptation and various other aspects of the production. So he said he almost missed it, and then someone offered him a ticket, and he went, and for what it's worth, he said it was one of the greatest musical theater experiences he's had in recent years. So there you go. I mean, I cannot even process how he would feel that way, especially someone who obviously is heavily into opera and into the operatic version of the piece. But whatever they did, Susan Laurie Parks and Diane Paulus and Deirdre Murray and Audra McDonald and the cast very much appealed to him. So I don't know what to say, but there you are. How people who obviously have a huge. This is obviously not a case where I could say, oh well, he doesn't know anything. You know, he doesn't know anything about opera. He's just ignorant. I mean, it's the opposite of that. So I can't say that. It's sometimes it's just a matter of a difference of opinion.
So let's talk about other folks who have differences in opinion. there are people that are in the camp that Into the Woods is not really quite a production that should transfer to Broadway, and there's others that are saying that it should transfer, and it will. I know, Michael, you're going to go see Into the Woods tonight. Peter has already seen it. Into the Woods extended through September 1st. So You know, what's your take on this? I know that you haven't seen it, but is Broadway ready for another Into the Woods so soon? And Peter, what do you think about a transfer?
No, I don't believe it's going to happen. I think it may have happened, in fact, if we hadn't had that revival a few years ago. But the fact that that revival was not successful would indicate that there's not enough interest in an Into the Woods revival on Broadway. I think we can say for sure that if it did transfer, Amy Adams wouldn't come with it. And while I'd like to think that people are going to Central Park to see Into the Woods, I'm sure a number of them are going to see Amy Adams. So they're going to lose her if they move. And I don't believe it's going to happen. But I think it might have happened had we not had that unsuccessful revival a few years ago.
Yeah, I agree with that, too. It does seem that it's really, it's for that type of a show especially. I mean, I know that it is considered to be Sondheim's most successful, or one of his most successful shows in terms of, both the original production and how often it's produced elsewhere, and just, you know, all things considered. But it's still, you know, Sondheim, and it will never be as popular at the box office as many other things that are not anywhere near as good. So I was surprised. And then especially since the reviews, again, it feeds into what we were just talking about, the reviews all over the place. Very negative in the New York Times and I believe the Wall Street Journal. Some rave reviews from other quarters. And I haven't spoken to many people who actually saw it. So I can't speak to the word of mouth. So I'm very curious to see it tonight. But I don't know. I can't imagine that anyone would transfer it with the expectation of making their investment back, let alone making money. If somebody wanted to transfer it just for the love of theater, and they're willing to lose money on it, then it might happen, I suppose.
Well, the other thing, too, is it looks lovely out there because, after all, we're in the woods. And you know that if they move it inside, immediately critics are going to say, well, it doesn't have the charm that it had when it was really in the woods. Yeah, so it's going to lose that dynamic. And you can put all the fake trees you want around it to make it look as if you're still in Central Park, but it's not going to look like Central Park. And that unique experience that people are having out there will not be able to be replicated inside whatever theater they choose.
Yeah, one more reason. When you think of the things that have transferred successfully from the park, I don't think they really depended that much
they
on
didn't.
The park as
no,
a setting.
Not at all.
Pirates of Penzance.
No.
Two
Gentlemen.
Yeah, Two Gentlemen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing. And you know, then there's another thing, and I want to be careful here. Donna Murphy is one of the leads, and Donna Murphy has in the past had problems in sustaining a lengthy run of a Broadway show and without being absent a lot for health reasons or whatever. And since Wonderful Town, she has really not been in a position to do so. The closest that she came was Love Music, but that only wound up running how long, Peter?
Not very, but people in the picture she was in too, right?
Right, but what I mean is none of them was an extended run.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I can certainly hope that she is over that, and I don't know. I honestly do not know how often, if at all, she missed during Love Music or The People in the Picture. But I would think that producers would be skittish about that because there was so much negative publicity over whatever issue she had in Wonderful Town, and really that she had gotten the reviews for that production. I mean, it got good reviews overall, but she was considered to be the star and the draw. And when she couldn't be there, it had a tremendously negative effect on that show. So I don't know. justifiably or not, it would seem that she has a very bad reputation in that respect. So that's one more reason why I, you know, and if Amy Adams can't do it for film commitments until, you know, next year or whatever, then plus this, and that there are no other, nothing else approaching really a major name in the show, I don't know.
Well, I would think that Amy Adams would be much more of a draw than Donna Murphy, and I'm a big fan of Donna Murphy, but certainly.
Well, yeah, but Donna is a huge draw among the theater community. So
a great star. I think she is really one of the best we have. I think she's an amazing performer. And I remember a friend of mine saying, when she does 100 Easy Ways to Lose a Man in Wonderful Town, she's almost like Sybil because she has so many personalities that she's displaying. She really can do anything. And in this show, by the way, of course, the witch gets very, very testy in many instances. And I think Donna is phenomenal at portraying exasperation, that people aren't keeping up with her, that she knows more than they do. And the witch does, you know, come on, do this, do that. Why aren't you doing this? She fully expects people have the same mindset as the witch now. I'm talking about the witch now, not Donna herself. So that's part of the fun of the character, that she really expresses that exasperation so wonderfully.
You know, that's funny the way you describe the character, because it seemed to me that's also a great description of the character that she played so brilliantly in Anyone Can Whistle at Encores.
Sure.
You know, definitely, who is really kind of a witch in a way, isn't she?
Yes.
Cora Hoover Hooper. So, yes, yeah, I mean, she's done, she was great in that. She was great in Follies at Encores.
Sure.
There is no doubt that certainly that she can be incredible, you know. But it seems like lately that she has done the short run special event things more than the long running open ended Broadway show things. So
I became a fan, by the way. I keep a list of my own favorite performances of the season, and Donna won. I put that in quotation marks, big bold quotation marks. Donna won way back in the 80s in a supporting role for Birds of Paradise, a musical that played at the now defunct Promenade Theater, in which she was magnificent. And that's the first time I noticed her. And I was delighted to see that she became a star, because she was so terrific in that musical about community theater putting on a musical. And even then, there was a bit of exasperation in her, because she wanted to get things done. She wanted the ambitious musical to be produced as opposed to the safe show. And it was quite a performance. So I'm delighted for her success. And I hope that all these problems are behind her. I mean, suddenly Wonderful Town's a long time ago. And we all get sick, you know, and maybe that was just then, and maybe it isn't relevant anymore, and I'm hoping it's not. I'm sure it's not, too.
I hope so, too.
You know,
another thing she I didn't see it, but and I'm not sure if it was before, I think it was before Birds of Paradise, Peter, but was it Song of Singapore?
I think that came later.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
She apparently was amazing in that.
Your point here, because the night I went, she was out. So I'm proving your point here, Michael.
So somebody who really can't be out of a show is Frankie Valli. Frankie's coming in to do a limited engagement at the Broadway Theater in October. Do we see this as a one-week competition between the Jersey Boys and the Jersey Boys, or...?
This is the type of thing where it helps both shows, I think.
Yeah.
More to the point, I dare say this might not be happening had there not been Jersey Boys around the corner.
Of course. Absolutely. I think that, you know, I think in my opinion, Jersey Boys has helped Frankie Valli's career more than Frankie Valli has helped the Jersey Boys in the recent days.
Mm-hmm.
With John Lloyd Young back in the show, Jersey Boys tickets are once again wicked hard to get. That's a twist on
yes, gotcha.
on what they say up in Maine.
So, well, I do think it was interesting that this engagement was announced right on, directly on the heels, like, wasn't it like 2 days after this big New York Times article on the Midtown Man, which is a group consisting of, let's see, Daniel Ricciard, Michael Longoria, J. Robert Spencer, and Christian Hoff, who were all in the original company of Jersey Boys and who have been performing around, apparently very, very successfully around the country.
Yeah. They also had some sort of lawsuit or something.
Yes, they had. They were originally called The Boys in Concert, I think. Yeah. And although from the beginning, they never sang only Four Seasons repertoire. They apparently sing a lot of songs from that period. You know, the guy group songs of, you know, various groups. But I guess that some people were concerned that this would be confused with the show Jersey Boys. And so there was a lawsuit and they some kind of a agreement was reached or whatever, and they now call themselves the Midtown Men.
Somebody else who probably can't be out of a show if it comes to Broadway would be Bradley Cooper. We talked about Bradley Cooper's production of The Elephant Man that's up at Williamstown Theater Festival, possibly coming into Broadway a couple of months ago. We talked about it, and it seems that there's inklings that it might come after Bradley's schedule frees up somewhere in the winter time or something like that.
I thought they said didn't they say next fall, or am I wrong?
They might have said next fall. Maybe I misread that. Let's see what I have here. Well, I would trust your memory more than mine. So next fall, you are the actor told extra. Extra is breaking Broadway news. Did we ever think we'd see that day? Well, they won't be part of, if they come in next fall, they won't be part of this year's Tony Awards. And you know who else won't be part of this year's Tony Awards?
Who?
Alan Wasser and Associates.
Oh, right.
So this is a little bit inside baseball. So if you don't know who Alan Wasser is, he's it's an office run by Alan Wasser and a handful of other Broadway producers. Who had been for the last 4 years the producers of the Tony Awards, and they've decided not to renew their contract, which I thought was interesting. I wonder, I haven't really been beating the bushes because I've been more or less on summertime vacation, but I'll have to get in touch with everybody and see if there's a story behind the story there. Because why would you give up a gig like that? That's interesting. You don't have to raise money. You don't care if it makes money. It's kind of a built-in thing. It's very prestigious and high profile. I don't know.
Maybe they were embarrassed by Neil Patrick Harris upside down being the rafters. That's probably it. You know, they don't want to be associated with that. So.
And now we feel like we have not officially 100% determined that the show is going to be at the Beacon again. Is that right?
No, it's 100. I think they signed a 5-year contract 2 years ago. So I think the next 3 years or so is going to be at the Beacon.
Oh, okay.
I think it's, and they're getting more and more, as far as the folks that I've talked about it that work in the Tony Awards productions, they've become more and more comfortable and enamored with the Beacon versus Radio City, which I think Radio City's a better venue for it, but. You know, we'll see what happens after the 5 years are up. And I, as far as I understand, the
Cirque du Soleil is bringing a new show. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. One of the big winners from the Tony Awards in June was Once, and Once recouped their investment after 21 weeks, which seems to have been some sort of record or something.
Well, certainly in recent times, I would think so.
Once is knocking them dead. It's hard to get tickets to Once, but certainly is the proof is in the pudding that the Tony Award winner might in fact bring a lot of ticket sales to the door, because I you don't see much at least in town, perhaps it's out of town, advertising for once.
I agree. Yeah, so, maybe they feel they don't need it. Yes, that happens too.
Yeah.
So other
things happening this week are that we just passed a milestone for The Lion King, became the fifth longest running show in Broadway history, which just actually ironically surpassed A Chorus Line, Mr. Hamlisch's marquee performance. So have you guys been back to Lion King recently? I think, Peter, did you go and take a child? Or was that a different, was Mary
Poppins? No, that was Mary Poppins, yeah. No, I went to Lion King about 3 years ago. And I don't like the show very much, frankly. I like The Circle of Life. And there was that famous Oscar Hammerstein statement, if the first 10 minutes of your show is good, you can coast for a long time. I don't like the fart jokes. I don't think it's nearly as good as Ragtime, and I think Ragtime should have won. So that year's Tony, but I can understand why it's impressive as spectacle, because certainly Julie Taymor in Happier Times came up with those hybrid costumes that are essentially centaurs when you think of them, for man and beast being melded together. So I think that's what's really made The Lion King a special event. But I truly believe if Walt Disney were alive, he would have fired those people who did the fart jokes and the joke where one character says, I've got to buck myself up. And the other person says, you've already bucked up royally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really a joke that depends on that four-letter word. While the adults in the audience are laughing in spite of themselves and their kids turn to them and say, why are you laughing? I think that must have been an awkward moment for some parents who don't want to deal with that word with their kids. So anyway, but there it is. You know, the record in the 80s we thought would be unassailable, that Chorus Line would ever be, surpassed in the length of a run, and now here it is in sixth place. Amazing.
Wow. Yeah, I don't disagree about the fart jokes and all of that, Peter. And also, I would add, as I think I may have said before, I don't want to overanalyze, but to me, The Lion King has always been very homophobic in terms of the Scar character. I think, like, kind of dangerously so. And I guess that should really make me kind of hate it alone. But aside from all that, I actually would have to say that it's my favorite of the Disney shows.
Understand that point of view too. Certainly.
All things considered, and I guess I probably resaw it around the time Peter did, and for what it's worth, I thought it was in terrific shape. They made a point of keeping. I guess was that roughly when it moved?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. I saw it not long after it moved to the Minskoff, and it was in terrific
me too.
Shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the scenic the really big incredible scenic moments are spaced out well enough that they give the show a big lift. And I like some of the songs a lot, even some of the new songs. There's a beautiful ballad that was written that Simba sings, adult Simba sings, that was not in the show. I mean, it's so immaterial what any of us says.
Sure.
But for what it's worth, it's my favorite of the Disney shows. I really don't like Mary Poppins at all. And I guess actually, in retrospect, Beauty and the Beast looks better than it initially did to me. Although at the time, I thought there was something of a lack of creativity in the adaptation to the stage.
And but also, it looked like the sets looked like they came from a warehouse where they used to store Schubert operettas from way
yeah.
back when.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Very flat sets.
Yeah.
Mm. I have to agree with Peter it's not an unheard of observation that the show goes downhill after The Circle of Life. I much prefer the movie versus the stage show, but I have to say that when they sing the new song, He's in You, I get choked up.
Mm.
I think it's a beautiful song and it's a beautiful sentiment and something that I think was a definite positive when they added that to the stage show. And perhaps they'll go in reimagine the movie and put that into the movie at one point in the Lion King 4D when it comes out in 2099 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So coming up again, the last thing we're going to talk about today is that Santa is bringing us presents, isn't he now? The holiday season schedule for Broadway is getting very full with A Christmas Story that we talked about previously is going to be on Broadway, but we haven't talked about Elf and Grinch coming back, which is really going to be a lot of opportunities to see holiday-themed musicals in and around the Thanksgiving to New Year's window, and then they'll close and go away and hopefully come back in the future. So,
well, I think we did briefly mention Grinch because that's the one that's at the Paramount. Is that right? The theater at Madison
Square. Oh, that's Garden. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We did mention that. But
formerly called the Paramount, the theater at Madison Square
that's
Garden.
That's right.
But yeah, but Elf was news. Yeah.
So
and I know Peter and I, and I forget what your opinion is, James. We both love Elf, so I think we're very happy.
Elf was excellent. I'm happy to see it come back, and we talked about it last year. For anybody who wants to listen to what we said last year, you know, run back to BroadwayRadio.com and check out the archive. It's a good time for me to mention here that all of our show notes and previous episodes and things like that are at BroadwayRadio.com. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and myself. You can get in touch with us. Let us know what you think of the shows. Have suggestions. Disagree with us. We have a lot of people that disagree with us.
Imagine.
And that's okay. That's absolutely okay. We won't.
Of course it is.
Won't dislike.
How could it be otherwise?
You could also subscribe to the podcasts. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time a new episode of Broadway Radio comes out, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. And, I should mention that next week I'm going to be out of town. So we're going to try and record a show on Monday evening, but it might not happen. So if next week we are not there, don't fret. We will be returning the following week, but we're going to try to record something on the road while I'm on the road, but who knows how it's going to happen. Michael, finally, you were not here. You were on vacation when Isaac Hurwitz from Nymph came and joined us. And I know that you wanted to say something. So, don't you?
Yes. I thought that Isaac did a very good job of explaining the situation with Nymph. I'm sorry if I sounded so negative. It was I had one or two conversations with past participants who really had major issues with Nymph. But as I think I said from the beginning, I want to hasten to say that this was not this year. It was in past years. So I'm sure it's a learning experience for everyone. You know, if there are issues in terms of people feeling that there are quote unquote hidden costs, maybe things that they don't know about from the beginning, it sounds like Isaac would agree that that's something that they just need to really keep the lines of communication open, and hopefully that will happen less in the future. As to whether it's better to do a show as part of a festival like Nymph or the Fringe or whatever, or to just do one's own standalone production, there are obviously tremendous amounts of variables that go into that, and people have to really make their own decision based on so many different things, you know, the cost and how much extra attention they might get to be part of a festival as opposed to doing it on their own, and weigh that against the extra costs. But I certainly hope that I hope that Nymph does continue and flourish. And I would also hasten to add that while I did not enjoy Forever Man this year, the three or four shows that I saw last year, I enjoyed all of them, most specifically Pride and Prejudice, and also the concert they did of songs from the unproduced musical version of Gatsby. So that was a very good experience that I had last year. So I do wish them well, and anyone who's in any kind of a festival situation, the logistics of them are, you know, so must be so incredibly challenging. I for one, don't know if I would want to be an administrator of a festival, because while they're very valuable, I just think they're probably extremely difficult. But having said that, I just saw the first show that I'm seeing in the Fringe, the New York International Fringe Festival, called Scarlet Fever, all about a young woman who's obsessed with Scarlett Johansson. And I'm thrilled to report that it was excellent. Very, very well written by Josh Duboff and a cast of really fantastic actors led by this amazing woman named Alex. I guess it's, well, it's T-R-O-W. I don't know if that's Trow or Tro, but as the central character, the one who's obsessed with Scarlett. And just really, really very well done and very well written. And
Michael, I think, have you been to gay camp?
No, but I'm going this week.
Oh, okay. Then we'll talk about that next week.
Okay, you know, great.
Because I did see gay camp, and that's certainly worth discussing as well.
Oh, excellent. Great.
All right. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to be at Hilton Head, South Carolina next week. And what do you guys got coming up on your schedules?
Work.
Work. Yeah, Peter's got a lot of writing to do. A writer writes. Michael, you see more French stuff?
Well, I'm seeing Gay Camp. I'm seeing a reading of a play called 40 CPS, as in Central Park South.
Uh-huh.
That I know people who live there.
Famous building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is it famous?
Well, a lot of famous people have lived at 40 Central Park South.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very...
It's right on the corner of 7th Avenue.
If you do have the means, I highly recommend it.
I think... I think that Michael Bennett lived there, and I think that's why this has something to do tangentially with the production of A Chorus Line. But I will report back.
Great. All right. So hopefully you guys will hear from us next week. And if not, as I said, listen to us the following week. But on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.